Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 12th of June. Our guest is the author of a fascinating book, The First Word, The Search for the Origins of Language. And she has this question in the epilogue, which you may want to think about, and how would you answer this? The epilogue asks, what would happen to language if you shipwrecked a boatload of pre-linguistic babies on the rocky shores of Galapagos? That's a good question, isn't it? So we'll talk about that. But we have many things to discuss with Christine Keneally. She's a journalist and author who has written for The New Yorker, The New York Times, Slate, and New Scientist. The book, The First Word, The Search for the Origins of Language, was published in hardback in 2007. It's now out in paperback, published by Penguin. Before becoming a reporter, she received her PhD in linguistics from Cambridge University and a bachelor's in English and linguistics from Melbourne University. She was born and raised in Melbourne, and she is with us this hour to talk about language. It's a fascinating book. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. And we also have this email you can use, which is talk@wpr.org. Talk@wpr.org. Christine, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's great to be here. Thank you.
It's going to be fun. What I loved is that you talked to so many people, and all of these people had different ideas, and you were with them on their deals, their ideas about how language started, and then you'd meet somebody else, and they'd have a different idea, and you could go down that path. There are a lot of different ideas about this, right?
There really are. There are a lot out there. Oh, I think one of the best things about this field right now is because it's really sort of boomed in the last 10 to 15 years, there is a kind of general coherence as well. You know, it was a field that was actually ignored for a very long time. And maybe because of that, it's attracted some really brilliant maverick people right now. And I definitely had the experience of being swayed and persuaded by every different person I spoke to. But there is a kind of general idea now that we're beginning to have a glimmer of how language actually came to be. And we didn't know this at all, 10, 15, 20 years ago.
And you say that it was taboo, really, for a long time. Why?
Yes, it's such a strange story. So in 1866, people were very interested in this subject. There was obviously a lot of talk about evolution around that time. And the French Linguistic Society took umbrage at the fact that you couldn't really know how it happened. Certainly, and it's true, at that time, there was no evidence one way or another. We could never really know. There was no technology. There was sort of no way of working it out. So they actually issued a ban on the subject and said, look, we're just not going to publish anything on this topic at all. And the English Linguistic Society followed suit a couple of years later. And ever since then, I mean, even though the ban was never officially lifted, it became this kind of embarrassing subject to ask about, and people just didn't like to do it.
Isn't that something? So after talking to all of these people and all of this research, what are your theories or what are the most prominent theories about when the first word was uttered?
I think the first word was probably uttered, or whatever was like the first word, the first beginnings of the word, a really long time ago, much longer ago than we ever imagined. I think around 2.5 billion years ago, people started to develop the platforms for what we would call language today. And I think one of the ways we can begin to guess at this and know this stuff is we sort of realize nowadays that language is not so much a single thing. It's a suite of abilities. And we seem to share some of these with animals, certainly not all of them. So people are looking at other living animals now and finding out what components of this language suite that they seem to have some talent with, and then working backwards from that, developing a kind of trajectory back through time as to when all of these different mental abilities and even physical traits came into play.
Mm-hmm. And all of that is quite new, too, isn't it? The study of some parrots, the study of bonobos and sheep and all kinds of animals.
Yeah, it is. And there are some really impressive people working on those subjects now. And I think one of the things that actually held that stuff back for a long time and why it's so new now is because you know, it was, it in itself, it was kind of taboo. People didn't like to think of animals as having minds, as them doing anything that we would call cognition at all. You know, there was this kind of idea that animals were just automata and they just didn't think in any way that was like humans. And we're sort of discovering more and more, no matter what animal you look at, there's a lot of stuff going on. And some of it pertains to language as well as just general thinking.
Right. So if you go back and play this out in whatever way you want to, the first person utters the first word. How does the second person have can he or she utter the same word as well, or how does the second person know what the first person was saying?
Yeah. Well, that is definitely one of the great paradoxes of language evolution, this idea of like, okay, so someone invented it or someone came up with this idea, but then how did the person they were talking to know what was going on at the same time? I think the idea is more that it happened incredibly slowly and incrementally over a very long, evolutionary time. So before there were even words, what we think was going on was some kind of gestural communication. And one of the reasons people think this nowadays is because we've just realized that other apes, our close relatives, like chimpanzees and also like orangutans, who are still great apes but just a bit more distantly related, they gesture in ways that are very like human gesture. They gesture freely and flexibly in all the ways that we do. And they do some really interesting things with gesture. So, for example, there was an experiment about a year ago on orangutans, and what the experimenters did was, you know, one of them was sort of standing there with food next to them, and the orangutan would start gesturing to the human that they wanted some of the food. So the human at times would pretend that they didn't really know what the orangutan wanted. They sort of got it, but they weren't quite sure. And then what the orangutan did was something that you or I would do in a very similar situation. They started repeating and emphasizing that gesture over and over again. So perhaps they had been pointing or something like pointing. Apes don't really point in the way we do, but perhaps they'd been gesturing towards it, and then they started going on and on and on and really emphasizing that. In another situation, the experimenter pretended they did not understand what the orangutan wanted at all. So in that case, what the orangutan did was it came up with a completely different gesture. Again, in the same way that probably you or I, if we were pointing at something and the person didn't seem to understand what we wanted, maybe we'd start waving at it or gesturing our body towards it. So what you have there is this platform for fairly sophisticated communication. You know, there is meaning that's being transacted between that human and that orangutan, although there isn't sort of language per se in place. There are no words. So then once you've got something like that, we imagine that on top of that, maybe the first word was something that accompanied a gesture. And because the gesture is already there, then, you know, if that happens very slowly over generations and generations, you get this build-up and this accretion of sort of gesture words. And then on top of that, again, much later in the picture, you start to develop quite sophisticated human syntax. You know, all the rules of grammar and the ways in which different languages combine words and put them together in these complicated ways.
Right.
So I think the key is just slowly and incrementally over time, and also the recognition that before humans were humans per se, there was already a lot of very smart communication and thought going on.
Mm-hmm. And how do you get to the point where the first words that are uttered become different words, and we have something like, 6,000 languages all over the world? Why?
That's right. Yeah.
How did that happen?
Well, people think that the probably most likely scenario for that is about 100,000 years ago, a small tribe of what were effectively modern humans left Africa, and this small group populated the entire world. You know, modern humans lived in Africa for, you know, at least 100,000 or so years beforehand. I mean, of course, we'd been there for all time, but, you know, what we would recognize as creatures that look a lot like us had already lived there for quite some time. But this small group successfully left Africa, spread out across the entire world. It's probably the case that they had one single language, and that they took that with them. And then as those groups split and spread out and went to different countries and were separated from that, just because language changes inevitably, in the same way that biology changes, you know, if you isolated a group of humans on another planet, you know, eventually they'd probably look a little different to what we look like today. Language does the same thing. It has a dynamic nature. So we think that that was like the grandparent of all languages. And nowadays, because we've been, so that they've been split apart for about 100,000 years, that these are, in a sense, the grandchildren of that first language.
Mm-hmm. What is this Big Bang theory of language?
The Big Bang theory of language was one that people used to talk about with greater seriousness about 10 years ago, and sort of the evidence is starting to weigh against that now. So the idea is that, you know, that human beings underwent a single genetic mutation, again, around about 100,000 years ago or in that general time frame, and then from that single genetic mutation, all of language arose. We went from being an ape-like creature, like chimpanzees, and then after just this one fortuitous change in somebody's genes, which then spread through the entire population eventually, we developed language. And that was the kind of, even though it was a topic that wasn't much discussed, that was sort of the favorite idea for a long time. And mainly it was because people just couldn't understand how language just even came about, because it's so different in many ways as a whole from what other animals have. But now, you know, as people understand genes more, they certainly realize that language seems to be supported by many, many, many different genes. And there is no one single mutation that could probably cause anything as complicated as language to arise.
And the ability to speak is centered, I guess we used to think it was in one part of the brain, and now it's in many parts of the brain?
That's exactly. It's exactly the same story as the gene story. We used to sort of think, well, maybe there's one single gene that's the gene for language. And in the same way, we thought, well, maybe there's one part of the brain where language lives. And if you took out that brain, you'd almost have a kind of a chimpanzee. But it's not the case. Language, there are areas of the brain that are really important for different parts of language, but language also seems to be supported all over the brain. You know, there are circuits activated when we speak or when we sort of perceive language that involve many different areas. So the basic message is it's just a very complicated thing and it requires a lot of support.
You talk about asking your linguistics teacher in the early 90s a question which seems to me was a terrific question, you know, about the origin of the first word. And your teacher said, you know, leave that on the table. We're not going to talk about that.
Yeah,
it seemed to me to be a fascinating question.
It was kind of a funny moment for me, too, because it was one of my very first lectures at all. And, you know, I'd gotten to university. I finally thought I'd, you know, discover the answers to everything I ever wanted to know. And so I asked my professor, you know, well, where did language come from? It was, you know, one of the first linguistic lectures I'd ever attended. And she said, we just don't know. And exactly, just not only that, but, you know, we just don't even really ask. And that was partly the fault of this kind of embarrassment about language, you know, on top of this historical story where there was this sort of the banning in 1866, Noam Chomsky has been this sort of incredibly powerful figure in linguistics for a very long time, and of course in many other worlds as well. And Noam Chomsky has been, people have said that he's sort of anti-evolution, and that's certainly not the case, but it is the case that he just hasn't been that interested in this question of language evolution. And so my professor kind of came from that school, as did many professors at the time, because of his influence, and because he wasn't interested and he didn't think we could probably work out the answer, people just didn't even want to ask.
And why should we ask?
Why should we ask? Because language is both the thing that makes us human and also the thing that connects us to all other animals. It really is this unique trait because of the way that we put all of these different skills together. And I think you could certainly make the case that, you know, we wouldn't have the modern world we do today without language. All the technology that we have arises from the fact that we just have language in the first place. Just the fact that we can put words together with rules and create these incredible worlds. But at the same time, it's not the thing that separates us from other animals. It's something that connects us to them. They have some pretty sophisticated abilities as well.
Let's welcome phone calls for you. Here's our phone number. Christine Keneally is our guest, and the book is The First Word, The Search for the Origins of Language. And you can join us at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. You could send an email if you'd like to do that. That's talk@WPR.org, even the fact that we can do that, you can send us an email. Isn't that extraordinary? This whole, we call in, we talk, you send emails, it's all mysterious. Christine is a journalist and an author who has written for The New Yorker, The New York Times, Slate, and New Scientist. The book, it was published in hardback in 2007 and is now just out in paperback by a Penguin. She is a linguist. She has her PhD in linguistics from Cambridge University and a bachelor's in English and linguistics from Melbourne University. 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050 if you're joining us in the Milwaukee area. And the epilogue of the book, you know, think about this during the hour and call in when you have an answer, because it's an interesting thing to think about. What would happen to language if you shipwrecked a boatload of pre-linguistic babies on the rocky shores of Galapagos? And I think she found some 15 scientists who answered that question and had some very interesting answers. We'll talk about that as well. Join us. Don't be silent, because we're talking about language. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Christine Keneally is our guest. Her book is The First Word, The Search for the Origins of Language. And our phone number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. And we have lines open, so really feel free to join this really interesting conversation. Let's look for a moment, Christine, at the language-related fossils. You talk about interpreting cranial remnants, skull size, and also the length of the neck vertebrae. What does that tell us about language?
So the cranial remnants, the size of the skull, all it really gives you is an idea of the size of the brain. And, you know, that's just a very general guide to the possibility of having language. We know, so chimpanzees have, I think their brains are approximately a third the size of modern humans, and chimpanzees don't have language in the way that we do. So that's one of the ways people started investigating this question, looking at just basic brain size and saying, you know, was this brain really big enough to support language? It seems these days that the question should really be a lot more complicated than that, that brain size doesn't necessarily indicate, you know, that whether you can have language or not. There's been a number of experiments, but also a number of operations, surgeries, where people have had to have half of their brain removed for various disorders. And a lot of these people go on to live pretty normal lives. And, you know, if they get the right kind of therapy, they also have language. Their brains are effectively half the size of, you know, a normal human brain. And we know now that, you know, they can certainly support language. So it's a murky kind of picture, but it sort of gives you a general idea. The neck vertebra and just the back sort of pertain to just breathing and the ability to support all the different muscles that that we use when we use speech. So the fossils were what people really began with, and then what's been happening more recently are these sort of cleverer ways of trying to get at the same question, because the fossil picture just really doesn't take you that far with something as elusive as language. Mm-hmm. So that's why we get all these comparative experiments with other animals and some really interesting stuff going on with different kinds of technology. So, for example, with MRI, you know, people can look at what's going on in the brain of someone actually as they're talking or as they're listening to language, and that can give you an idea of what's happening in the brain and what you sort of need to be going on in the brain when you have language.
Mm-hmm. So you write that finding out how language started requires technology that was invented last week and experiments that were conducted yesterday.
That's right. One of the most interesting ways of looking at language evolution these days is this thing called digital modeling. And effectively what's going on is these guys are writing software and code, and they're setting up, you know, inside software, inside computers, you know, little virtual communities, and they set them up in different sort of situations. You know, maybe one community starts out with no language at all, maybe another one is able to produce certain sounds, you know, and they kind of like they flick their button and they get generations of these things to roll over and over and over, and they can make them go for thousands of generations and then sort of look at what comes out at the end if you start a community off with the ability to sort of make three vowels, you know, what happens at the other end after thousands of generations. You know, this is not something that you know, your average human being, no matter how smart they are, can sort of sit back in their armchair and actually think about and come up with an answer to. These are mathematically constrained and, you know, and they operate according to certain rules. And, you know, we couldn't possibly imagine thousands of iterations of human generations. You know, your brain just doesn't work like that. So that's one of the really interesting ways that people have been looking at this. And people have only been doing that just for a very short amount of time.
Mm-hmm. And it is remarkable, all that there is in language, right, that we go from maybe a grunt, you know, I'm hungry, to a sonnet.
Yeah, absolutely. There's one of the first candidates that people used to consider as, like, maybe, like, the first word were these things called alarm calls. And lots of small animals make alarm calls, and the most famous case is the vervet monkey. So they had three alarm calls. One was for eagle, one was for snake, and I think one was for leopard. And the reason why they have the different alarm calls, and not just, oh my gosh, there's a predator coming, get out of here, is because you need to react in different ways. If there's an eagle in the sky, you need to get under the trees. If there's a leopard coming along, you need to get up in the trees. The same goes for a snake. So people used to think, well, were these the first words that people ever used? Or that, you know, were these the first words that really ever existed? And then we sort of developed a much more sophisticated way of using words. People don't think that's the case these days because the alarm calls seem to be pretty much genetically controlled, or at least the basic structure of them is genetically controlled. And so the way they think about alarm calls is that they're more like laughter and crying. Now, of course, we still have laughter and crying. You know, language, words, and rules haven't replaced the laughter and the crying that goes on in humans. And, you know, even as we're speaking to each other today, you know, we've been sort of laughing a bit, and we're, you know, yet words are still coming out of our mouths. So these two really different things exist at the same time still in human beings. Hmm. The laughter and the crying is probably much more ancient even than language.
Mm-hmm. And what about with other species? Do they cry?
Do other species cry? You know, I've heard that they do. I didn't really come across that in my research so much, but I have heard that other animals cry. And I read something recently about animals laughing as well, even cats laughing. I have Burmese cats, so I've never seen that myself. But maybe other people could attest to that.
Our phone number, join us if you'd like. You're so silent today, I'm surprised. It's a conversation about language, everybody, and where the first words came from and why. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Or you can use the email, which would be fine, and that's talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org for you to join the conversation. There you go. In big numbers. Our guest is Christine Keneally. She is the author of The First Word, The Search for the Origin of Language, which has just been published in paperback. And while we wait for the phones to be answered here, you do talk about, and I would imagine this is a huge task, Christine, piecing together several million years of linguistic evolution without a single language fossil. It's a cross-discipline, multidimensional treasure hunt, but also the hardest problem in science today.
Yes. Yeah, I think I think some people, you know, were kind of stunned to hear it phrased that way, but it's certainly the case that, you know, we're just getting to this question now because we can, because all this stuff was just invented, because all this technology has come around. And I think, you know, perhaps ironically, perhaps just fortuitously, all the communications technology we now have these days has influenced it as well. Of course, you know, these different researchers have come up all over the place with these different ways of, you know, looking at animals, looking at gesture, looking inside the brain, measuring what's going on when we speak, that kind of thing. But at the same time, science itself, of course, has become a lot more communicative with email and with, I guess, just the ease of transport and traffic across the world. People are starting to talk to each other. Language evolution is a very special topic because there are a few people who specialize completely in this. But what has sort of come about is that many people from many different disciplines have come together to answer this question. So we've got, you know, of course, basic anthropology, you've got linguists, you've got geneticists, you've got these people who do the digital modeling of language. There are some people who are actually trying to program robots with different kinds of language ability and seeing what happens when they set them loose in the world. And then, of course, there's neuroscience. So, you know, if we weren't all communicating as freely across the world as we do today, this question couldn't really be answerable either.
Mm-hmm. So let's ask this question, because I think this is a fascinating one. The epilogue asking, what would happen to language if you shipwrecked a boatload of pre-linguistic babies on the rocky shores of Galapagos? And you found a number of renowned scientists who were willing to try and take a stab at that, right?
Yes. Yeah, this was definitely the most fun part of the book for me. It was just, and it was something I did right at the end, you know, after I'd been speaking to these people for years and years and years, and then it was finally an opportunity to have a little bit of fun. So, you know, only one researcher, you know, a really incredibly impressive researcher who's actually been looking at this question for longer than most, said that they would not involve language at all, that they would effectively become a silent human being, or we're all apes, but we would return more to our silent ape ancestry. But most of the researchers I spoke to believe really strongly that human beings would certainly invent language all over again. And the basic belief that unites them all is that, you know, we are biologically ready for language. Now, human beings are sort of inescapably language creatures. We have all this stuff going on in our brains. We have these sort of instincts that drive us to gesture in communicative ways. So some of them said that all you needed was two babies. If you had two babies by the time they grow up, just because of the sheer dynamic and interactions between them, they would stumble across language and develop it further. Others thought that you probably need about a village size worth of people, maybe about 30, you know, maybe the same size as that band of human beings that left Africa 100,000 years ago. And that once you had that number of people and then you had a couple of generations rolling over, language would pass through various primitive stages, but eventually you would get speaking human beings all over again.
Interesting. Let's go to some phone calls. Tom from Stoddard. Hi, Tom. Hi, Tom. Are you there? Hello, Tom. Tom.
Yes, hello.
Yeah, go ahead, Tom.
Yes, I was reading a book about, the books by Richard DeWald, and his book, I gotta catch my radio just a moment.
Hello, Tom. Okay.
Sorry about that.
All right.
Richard DeWald's book on bonobos has been so interesting. And then I was reading another book about primitives, and it was by a lady by the name of Morgan. I can't remember her first name, but she mentions that in the primitive period that primates had gone into an area that changed gradually, and there was a lot of water there, and they had to change their whole living style because they were living in a very moist, almost swampy area. And they learned that they had to hold their breath when they were in certain parts of that environment. And then they got to the point where they could speak because they were able to hold their breath. And there's been a lot of research with chimps, and they've taught them a lot of things that they know that the chimps understand, but they can't speak. I think they've only been able to speak about two or three words.
Yeah, the question of whether apes can speak is a really interesting one. I'm not familiar with that author Morgan that you speak of. Is that the aquatic ape hypothesis? That sounds like it might be something like that. I think the question of whether apes can speak is certainly one that we can answer pretty confidently these days, and the answer is definitely no, they can't speak at all in the way that we do. Interestingly, they make a lot of the same vowel sounds that human beings make, just not all of them, or the consonant sounds. But apes actually can communicate. There has been a long history of ape language research, and the bonobos that you speak of, there's a very famous bonobo called Kanzi. He's in Des Moines right now, and Kanzi can communicate. What Kanzi communicates with linguistically are pictures, and these pictures or lexigrams kind of act like words. And Kanzi and some of the other bonobos and chimpanzees at that facility have approximately 200 or 300 words that they're very confident and familiar with, and they can even use some simple structural rules to put them together. So even though they don't have this physical ability to speak like we do, there's actually a lot more overlap mentally, and they can grasp language but not necessarily express it in the way we do.
Thank you, Tom. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. I was just going to say, I think perhaps Tom meant Franz de Waal, not Richard de Waal.
Oh, right.
Works with a lot of bonobos. And, yes, he's done some really fascinating research on, you know, social interaction between bonobos and chimpanzees.
And we have a number of them here in Milwaukee, so he comes to Milwaukee frequently to study them at the zoo. Thanks, Tom, very much for the call. Nate from Milwaukee. Hi.
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 I'm interested in the guest's comment on whether the ability to name objects in our environment might be a candidate for first words, since my understanding is that psychologists identify that being able to name an object is one of our first steps in being able to conceptualize and think about that object.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I mean, that remains one of the more sort of speculative pieces of the puzzle, but that would definitely be one of my favorite sort of theories or ideas about it. I think a lot of people do research on reference and, you know, the ability to refer to objects in the environment. And even though many animals, you know, as we've been discussing today, have the ability to sort of manipulate parts of language like we do, there's still this really big debate about whether they can really refer to objects in the world in the ways that we do, and the sort of exactly the naming that you talk about. So that does seem to be one of the last pieces of the puzzle. And clearly that's one of the most important things for kids when they sort of bootstrap into language. So I think that's definitely, you know, one of the more human, if not exclusively human, aspects of language.
Here's an interesting email from Ray from Stevens Point. What is the relationship between words and ideas? Having in mind Stuart Shanker's book on the first idea, do we go from experience to its conceptualization to its articulation, or do we go from language to concepts to experience?
Well, I think, you know, once we have language, the puzzle, you know, the mystery is at once both a lot clearer and a lot more complicated, because what you get is language coming back in and influencing our thoughts in these really complicated ways. I think what we know from animals now is that, you know, animals certainly have thoughts. For example, some animals can understand certain kinds of number. Some animals can understand color and shape. And then, of course, there are all sorts of complex social relationships that animals have that shows that they understand, you know, the ways things add up in the world, the way objects work in space. So in a sort of really broad evolutionary picture, absolutely thought precedes language. Well, then once you get language, on top of that, you get this sort of real ramification of these thoughts that we have. And there are things that we have because we have language that I don't think other animals have. I think language gives us either the ability to develop those thoughts or perhaps even shapes those thoughts to, you know, for us to some extent. So concepts of time is a really interesting one. Some animals clearly have concepts of time, again, in a way we never thought they did. You know, birds cache food. That's one possible candidate. But chimpanzees will pick up tools and carry tools with them to sites where those tools are actually useful for them. So there's clearly some kind of future planning going on there in the minds of the chimpanzees. But humans talk about things like weeks. Now, a week is this really abstract thing. It actually involves counting days, another abstract thing. So in that sense, you know, language actually gives us that kind of thought or the ability to think that way.
We go next to Steele from Nina. Hi, Steele.
Yeah, good morning. Hey, just a comment on animals crying. There was a pair of birds called Say's Phoebe and outside of Tucson, and they would build a nest right over the door to this clubhouse for 2 years, and then people got got tired of them pooping, so they took the nest down. So they flew over a little ways, built another nest, and I lived out at this club. And one time I heard this mournful cry, and the two were sitting on a post, and I knew something was different, and I walked over to where the nest was, and someone had taken their nest down because they didn't want them pooping on the gliders. And then we've heard of elephants moving other elephants, and I think animals get shortchanged. I think we just have to learn how to understand, or, you know, but anyway, I believe they do cry because it was just the most mournful cry I've ever heard, and I had to check on it.
You know, I agree with you. I think animals do get shortchanged in a lot of ways, and animal emotion is also another one of these real sort of last bastions of research that people kind of ignored for a long time. The question of whether animals cry tears is certainly one I'm not sure what, you know, about the answer to, but I think you're right. I mean, I think animals absolutely express emotion in the ways we do.
Getting back to the question of whether or not we'll ever know the origin of the first word, do you think because of all the technology we have now that the answer to that is down the road in the not-too-distant future?
I think there, the sort of the picture is just going to get clearer and clearer and more detailed. And the answer of the first word itself, I think, is probably the last piece of the puzzle and may never actually come. But I think, you know, we have a really good idea about where to look for it. You know, some people talk about the communication between mothers and children as being one of the places where that sort of communication really got off the ground. You know, this idea that, you know, prehistoric mothers, ape mothers, you know, no matter how long ago it was, they have pretty similar concerns to the ones mothers do today. For example, they want their kids to eat, and they don't want them to, you know, go and poke the saber-toothed tiger or anything like
right.
that. So there's a really great argument to be made that, like, that sort of that referential communication, that naming that one of the callers was just talking about, actually took off in that relationship.
What was your first word? Do you know?
No, I don't know, actually. My first son's first word was Bob, and I have no idea where that came from. No one in our family is called Bob. It was very strange.
It is strange. Thanks very much for the call. We go to Carla from Onalaska next. Hi, Carla.
Hi. Good morning. I'm a speech therapist, and I work in a little town that is very strong in its Norwegian heritage, and I was working with a patient that had a question for me, and I think it relates to the topic. When they were taking a trip to Norway a few years back, and they were very confident in going to Norway because they were raised in a home here that their first language was Norwegian. And so they didn't feel like they needed to really study up and prepare for their trip. So they get there and they get off the plane and they get into the cab and they have going to talk to the cab driver for directions, and the cab driver has no idea what they're talking about.
Oh, no.
And turns out in their kind of exploration of why while they were there, the Norwegian that they spoke in their home here in the United States would be the equivalent of Old English for us.
Oh, my gosh.
So Norwegian had evolved and they had not evolved with it, so they were speaking a very old version of it in their home here and couldn't communicate there. So I just thought it was interesting as to related to what you're talking about.
What an interesting story.
That really is. That's fascinating. And what a surprise and disappointment for them. But I think such great evidence of, you know, what we were saying earlier, which is that language is just this completely dynamic thing. It always changes, even though in our lifetime, you know, in our lifetimes, we feel like we're speaking the same language from beginning to end. You know, it's this totally roiling thing, and just a few generations away from, you know, where it's being spoken. Yeah, as your clients found out, can change everything.
Here's an interesting email from Donna. Would your guest agree that sign language was probably the first language that primitive people used, and that this sign language could have become universal in communicating with other tribes?
Yeah. You know, there is some question about that still. I don't think that the first language that really got off the ground was sign language, in the sense that I don't think we fully evolved a really complicated sign language and then switched over to vocal language. But I do think that gesture, and probably even a more pantomimey kind of gesture, was absolutely crucial to language getting off the ground. And probably, you know, I think gesture and language and, you know, body movements and language have always been really closely intertwined. And probably earlier rather than now, gesture played more of a role. And then I think words started to take over more and more.
We're talking with Christine Keneally this hour, author of The First Word, The Search for the Origins of Language. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. She's a journalist and author who's written for The New Yorker, The New York Times, Slate, New Scientist, the book published last year, and it's now out in paperback, published by Penguin. She is also a linguist. She has a BA in English and Linguistics from Melbourne University and received her PhD in Linguistics from Cambridge University. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Christine Keneally, author of The First Word, The Search for the Origins of Language, is our guest, and we go next to Jan from Mequon. Hi, Jan.
Hi, good morning. This is so exciting. I cannot wait to read the rest of this book. Ever since the start of the hour, I have been puzzled over something. I'm actually shocked to hear that there was a ban on studying this. What were they afraid of finding out?
Well, I think, you know, when I first heard about this, I thought, you know, absolutely, this is kind of crazy. And, like, what kind of scientist, what kind of scholar actually bans asking questions? But I think that the bottom line is that this was, at that time, one of the more, well, I was about to say woo-woo, not the more woo-woo questions you could have asked, but certainly one of the least answerable ones. And I think they were concerned that people were just going to come up with stories. You know, like, we all have our favorite anecdotes and ideas about how language evolved, and it's really important in science to constrain those and make sure you're asking questions that can be answered in specific ways and making sure that you're not just sort of making stuff up. So I think that was the main thing, the idea that maybe people would become so, you know, entranced by their own fairy tales that they would start believing things that weren't actually true. The problem was, of course, that this idea of making things up and fairy tales stayed with the subject for so long that even when people were coming up with, you know, originally with some really smart experiments, for example, with apes, to actually look at the capabilities, the language capabilities of our closest relatives, that kind of taint still existed. And it's taken a while to shake that off.
Anything more, Jan?
Well, I want to know why this is different from any other scientific study. I mean, there were crazy woo-woo theories about everything.
Right,
always.
Right. You know, you're absolutely right about that. Well, I think that, you know, for example, when we're looking at just the basic evolution of the human body, you know, we have this sort of collection of fossils throughout time where, you know, you could theoretically lay all those fossils out in a line in one single space, and you could see the progression that's happened, you know, through the sort of the you know, walking on four legs to the standing upright and all the other things that went on, the sort of the growing head and all the rest of it. With language, because, you know, it's this ephemeral thing, it sort of comes out of our mouths, and of course it's so meaningful and palpable and real to us, but it doesn't actually leave any traces in the physical world. That's why people thought we just don't know how it happened. And that's been the big distinguishing factor. But now that, you know, we've been thinking about the problem for a while, people are coming up with other ways to sort of get over that problem of there being no obvious physical trace.
Thank you very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. An email from Claudia from Duluth. Hold on 1 second. My machine has to catch up here. Has your guest considered twin talk in research, the unique language that sometimes develops between twins and has meaning only to them?
Yeah, not for this book, but I sort of looked briefly into that a little while ago, and also into another language phenomenon that's sort of quite fascinating, talking in tongues, you know, otherwise known as glossolalia, when people sort of in religious or other settings actually speak this stream of sound that's quite complicated and sounds like language. I think in both cases, what you have is something that that kind of piggybacks on top of language itself. It's not something that's sort of invented, you know, out of thin air. It's like maybe, particularly in the case of twins who are sort of making up the language between them, kind of like a code maybe that, you know, these kids, I guess, use to, I don't know, to cement their relationship, to create a private space. But it's not quite the same as language evolving all over again.
Thanks very much for the call. Sheila from Union Grove.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm doing exactly what my question was about. When people who speak English, and that's the language that I'm most familiar with, don't know what to say or get a glitch kind of thing, we tend to say or And I don't know if there's any real description of what that sound is.
Right.
But I had two questions. Is that an international thing that they do in all languages? And it also occurs to me that they sound a little like a lot of real simple connective words, da.
Right.
And to me, that's kind of an origin kind of thought. And can I just add one more thing?
Sure.
There was, I've heard more than once that babies can actually speak any sound in any language. They have that capability, but they only really use the ones that are reinforced.
Right.
So
right.
If that's a fact, was initial language limited by what people heard? And anyhow, those are just thoughts. And my vote for the first word is no.
That also would definitely fit well between mother and child, right? So I think, well, to your first question, those kind of those space fillers that we have, those
right.
space holders that we have when we say R and arm and all the rest of it, the sounds themselves aren't really innate. They're definitely learned. We learn them from speakers around us. There I go with an arm. But it may be the case that, you know, perhaps there's some kind of influence of meaning after some point. But certainly all languages have them. What's universal is the fact that we all say the equivalent of ah or arm and that kind of sort of semi-word or pseudo-word. But the words themselves, different languages would say them differently. The babbling question is really interesting. You're talking about babbling and about the fact that when, you know, babies don't know how to speak, there's this phenomenon where they actually, when they sort of do their little lovely nonsense
right,
sound,
right, yeah.
they're
That's
actually
great.
Producing all the sounds of human language. So I was speaking about that to someone just recently, and I wrote about that in the first word. But there's been a little bit more evidence about babbling recently, and the idea is that it's actually maybe not all of the sounds of human language, but it certainly is completely unconstrained sound making. They're not in any sense making only the sounds of English. And absolutely, when we grow up, we lose the ability to make some of those sounds because we actually focus on making the sounds of our own language. So how that actually played out, you know, in the very beginning with evolution, we certainly would have had a sort of freer and less constrained sort of code about the kinds of sounds we were making before a specific language itself evolved. But I think that, you know, that's definitely part of the physical evolution as well. You know, human beings make an extraordinary number of very specific sounds when we make language. And, you know, our mouths and tongues had to evolve to become these really complicated machines that they did before we were able to do that. So again, over very slow evolutionary time, we would have been able to sort of add these sounds and make distinctions between them.
Thank you, Sheila, for the call. Kate from Brookfield, hi.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. One of the things I remember in an anthropology class I took a few years ago is one of their theories of why Homo sapien outcompeted the Neanderthal was language that we had it and they didn't.
Yeah.
But if we're going back a million years, that timeline doesn't work. Their theory was that they didn't have the right bone structure to have speech.
Right.
So I wanted to ask about that, and then that just a simple observation as a teacher of high school students, I think the first words were, "Hey, look at me," from a young man to a young lady.
You know, that is also a great suggestion. There's one researcher out there who talks about how the different life stages of human beings affect language, and, you know, that adolescent stage is a really crucial and interesting one, I think. You write about the Neanderthals. I mean, certainly, if we had full language 2.5 million years ago or a million years ago, that wouldn't apply at all because Neanderthals left Africa, or the ancestors of Neanderthals left Africa long before we did, and they actually lived successfully out here in the rest of the world for much longer than even modern humans have done so. The last Neanderthal died around about 37,000 years ago. But, you know, when you think about language evolving incredibly slowly over time, you know, it may be that we got to only a very sophisticated stage, you know, perhaps 100,000 years ago, but that you needed those millions of years and those small number of words in the first place to even get to the place we got to relatively recently. The Neanderthal question is a really interesting one. I think maybe we did outcompete them with language, but I think there are some other really good theories out there for why they died out and we didn't. Some people have suggested that in the same way that, you know, a couple of hundred years ago when different Westerners traveled to countries they'd never been to before and met with indigenous groups, you know, they brought diseases with them, like the common cold, for example, and that these had this terrible effect on these local populations. That may have been what happened to the Neanderthals after we left Africa 100,000 years ago when, you know, we brought out various different bugs with us.
Well, aren't you glad you asked that linguistics teacher about the origin of language? Where would you be now if you, if that answer had been different, right?
Right. I have no idea.
I know. Thank you so much for being with us. Thanks for the book. It was really, really interesting.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Christine Keneally, the book is The First Word, The Search for the Origins of Language. She's a journalist and author who's written for The New Yorker, The New York Times, Slate, and New Scientist. She is a linguist herself, has a PhD in linguistics from Cambridge University and a BA in English and linguistics from Melbourne University, where she was born and raised. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thank you, everybody, for all of your intriguing emails and phone calls. It was an interesting hour. Veronica Rickard is with you tomorrow on Friday, and I'll return with All Things Political Monday morning at 9. Thank you for listening. Keep listening a lot ahead here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.